Coriolanus didn't like being called that. Livia had taunted him about his parentless state when he was small, making him feel alone and unwanted when he was neither. Still, there was that emptiness that most other kids didn't really understand. But Lucy Gray did, being an orphan herself. It could be worse. I have the grandmam, that's my grandmother, and Tigress. Do you miss your parents? Lucy Gray asked. Oh, I wasn't that close with my father. My mother, sure. It was still hard to talk about her.
Do you?
A lot. Both of them. Wearing my mama's dress is the only thing keeping me together right now. She ran her fingers down the ruffles. It's like she's wrapping her arms around me. Coriolanus thought of his mother's compact, the scented powder. My mother always smelled like roses, he said, and then felt awkward. He rarely mentioned his mother, even at home. How had the conversation gotten here? Anyway, I think your song moved a lot of people.
That's nice of you to say, thank you. But it's not really a reason to sing in the interview, she said. If it's the night before, we can rule food out. I've got no reason to win over anybody at that point.
Coriolanus tried hard to think of a reason, but this time her singing would only benefit him. It's a shame, though, with your voice.
I'll sing you a few bars backstage, she promised.
He would have to work to persuade her, but for the moment, he let it drop. Instead, he let her interview him for a few minutes, answering more questions about his family and how they'd survived the war. He found her easy to tell things to, somehow. Was it because he knew that all he recounted would vanish in the arena in a few days? Lucy Gray seemed in better spirits. There had been no more tears. As they'd shared their stories, a sense of familiarity had begun to grow between them. When the whistle blew to signal the end of the session, she tucked his handkerchief neatly back into the pocket of his book bag and gave his forearm a squeeze of thanks. The mentors headed obediently to the main exit, where Professor Sickle instructed them, "You're to go to the high biology lab for a debriefing." No one questioned her, but in the halls they wondered aloud about the reason. Coriolanus was hoping it meant Dr. Gall would be there. His neatly completed questionnaire was in stark contrast to the spotty efforts of his classmates, and this could be another moment for him to stand out.
"Mine wouldn't speak, not a word," said Clemencia. "All I've got is what I had after the reaping, his name, Reaper Ash. Can you imagine naming your child Reaper and them ending up in the reaping?"
"There was no reaping when he was born," Lysistrata pointed out. "That's just a farming name."
"I guess that's true," said Clemencia.
"Mine spoke. I almost wish she hadn't," Arachne practically yelled.
"Why? What did she say?" asked Clemencia.
"Oh, it seems she spends most of her time in District 10 butchering hogs." Arachne made a gagging motion. "Ugh, what am I supposed to do with that? I wish I could make up something better."
Suddenly she stopped, causing Coriolanus and Festus to run into her.
"Wait, that's it."
"Watch it," said Festus, pushing her forward.
She ignored him and chattered on, demanding everyone's attention.
"I can make up something brilliant. I visited District 10, you know. It's practically my second home."
Before the war, her family had developed luxury hotels and vacation destinations, and Arachne had traveled extensively in Pan Am. She still bragged about it, even though she'd been as capital-bound as anyone else since the war.
"Anyway, I could come up with something better than the ups and downs of a slaughterhouse."
"You're lucky," said Pliny Harrington.
Everybody called him Pup, to differentiate him from his naval commander father, who watched over the waters off District 4. The commander had tried to mold him into his image, insisting Pup have a crew cut and shine shoes, but his son was a natural slob. He dug a piece of ham out of his braces with his thumbnail and flicked it to the floor.
"At least she isn't afraid of blood."
"Why? Is yours?" asked Arachne.
"No idea. She cried for 15 minutes straight."
Pup grimaced.
"I don't think District 7 prepared her for a hangnail, let alone the games."
"You'd better button your jacket before class," Lysistrata reminded him.
Oh, right, Pup sighed. He worked the top button and it came off in his hand. Stupid uniform.
As they filed into the lab, Coriolanus's pleasure at seeing Dr. Gall again was dampened by the sight of Dean Highbottom stationed behind the professor's table, collecting the questionnaires. He ignored Coriolanus, but then he wasn't particularly friendly to anyone else either. He left the talking to the head game maker. Dr. Gall poked at the mutation rabbit until the class had settled in, then greeted them with,
"Hippity-hoppity, how did you fare? Did they greet you like friends, or just sit there and stare?"
The students shot confused glances at one another as she retrieved the questionnaires.
"For those of you who don't know, I'm Dr. Gall, the head game maker, and I will be mentoring your mentorships. Let's see what I have to work with, shall we?"
She flipped through the papers, frowned, then pulled one out and held it up before the class.
"This is what you were asked to do. Thank you, Mr. Snow. Now what happened to the rest of you?"
Inside, he glowed. But he maintained a neutral expression. The best move now was to support his classmates. After a long pause, he spoke up. "I had good luck with my tribute. She's a talker, but most of the kids wouldn't communicate. And even my girl can't see the point of making an effort at the interview."
Sejanus turned to Coriolanus.
"Why should they? What does it get them?
No matter what they do, they'll be thrown into the arena and left to fend for themselves."
A murmur of assent came from the room. Dr. Gall peered at Sejanus.
"You're the boy with the sandwiches. Why did you do it?"
Sejanus stiffened and avoided her gaze.
"They were starving. We are going to kill them. Do we have to torture them ahead of time as well?"
"Huh. A rebel sympathizer," said Dr. Gall.
Keeping his eyes on his notebook, Sejanus persisted.
"Hardly rebels. Some of them were 2 years old when the war ended. The oldest were 8. And now that the war's over, they're just citizens of Pan Am, aren't they? Same as us. Isn't that what the anthem says the capital does? You give us light, you reunite. It's supposed to be everyone's government, right?"
"That's the general idea. Go on,"
Dr. Gall encouraged him.
"Well, then it should protect everyone," said Sejanus. "That's its number one job, and I don't see how making them fight to the death achieves that."
"Obviously, you don't approve of the Hunger Games," said Dr. Gall. "That must be hard for a mentor. That must interfere with your assignment."
Sejanus paused for a moment. Then he sat up straight, seeming to steel himself, and looked her in the eye.
"Perhaps you should replace me and assign someone more worthy."
There was an audible gasp from the classroom.
"Not on your life, boy," Dr. Gall chuckled. "Compassion is the key to the games. Empathy, the thing we lack. Right, Casca?"
She glanced at Dean Highbottom, but he only fiddled with a pen. Sejanus's face fell, but he didn't argue back. Coriolanus felt he'd ceded the battle, but could not believe he'd given up on the war. He was tougher than he looked, Sejanus Plinth. Imagine throwing a mentorship back in Dr. Gall's face. But the exchange only seemed to invigorate her.
"Now, wouldn't it be wonderful if everyone in the audience felt as passionately about the tributes as this young man here? That should be our goal."
"No,"
said Dean Highbottom.
"Yes, for them to really get involved," continued Dr. Gall.
She struck her forehead.
"You've given me a marvelous idea. A way to let people personally affect the outcome of the games. Suppose we let the audience send the tributes food in the arena. Feed them like your friend here did in the zoo. Would they feel more involved?"
Festus perked up.
"I would if I could bet on the one I was feeding. Just this morning, Coriolanus said maybe we should give odds on the tributes."
Dr. Gall beamed at Coriolanus.
"Of course he did. All right, then. You all put your heads together and figure it out. Write me a proposal on how this could work, and my team will consider it."
"Consider it?" asked Livia. "You mean you might actually use our ideas?"
Why not? If they have merit.
Dr. Gall tossed the stack of questionnaires onto the table.
What young brains lack in experience, they sometimes make up for in idealism. Nothing seems impossible to them. Old Kaska over there came up with the concept for the Hunger Games when he was my student at the university. Just a few years older than you are now.
All eyes turned to Dean Highbottom, who addressed Dr. Gall. It was just theoretical.
And so is this, unless it proves useful, said Dr. Gall. I'll expect it on my desk tomorrow morning.
Coriolanus sighed inwardly. Another group project. Another opportunity to compromise his ideas in the name of collaboration. Either have them cut entirely, or worse, watered down until they had lost their bite. The class voted on a committee of three mentors to draw the thing up. Of course, he was elected, and he could hardly decline. Dr. Gall had to leave for a meeting and directed the class to discuss the proposal among themselves. He and Clemencia and Arachne were to convene that evening, but since they all wanted to visit their tributes first, they agreed to meet at 8 o'clock at the zoo. Later, they'd go to the library to write up the proposal. Since lunch had been substantial, he didn't feel deprived by a dinner of yesterday's cabbage soup and a plate of red beans. At least they weren't lima. And when Tigris had scooped the last cupful into an elegant china bowl and garnished it with a few fresh herbs from the roof garden, it didn't look too humble to offer to Lucy Gray. Presentation mattered to her. As for the beans, well, she was starving. Optimism flowed through him as he walked to the zoo. Morning attendance may have been scanty, but now visitors were pouring in so quickly he wasn't sure he'd get a spot up front at the monkey house. His newfound status helped. As people recognized him, they allowed him to pass and even told others to clear a path. He was no common citizen. He was a mentor. He made straight for his corner, only to find the twins, Paolo and Didi Ring, camped out on his rock. The pair embraced their twinship wholeheartedly, sporting identical outfits, hair buns, and sunny personalities. They cleared out without Coriolanus having to ask.
You can take it, Corio, Didi said as she pulled her brother up from the rock.
Sure, we've already fed our tributes, added Paolo.
Hey, sorry you got stuck with the proposal.
Yeah, we voted for Pup, but no one backed us up.
They laughed and ran off into the crowd. Lucy Gray joined him immediately. Even though he wasn't dining with her, she devoured the beans after admiring how fancy they looked. Have you gotten any more food from the crowd? He asked her.
I got an old cheese rind from a lady, and a couple of other kids fought over some bread a man threw in. I can see all kinds of people holding food, but I think they're afraid to get too close, even though they've got these peacekeepers in here with us now.
She pointed to the back wall of the cage, where a quartet of peacekeepers stood guard.
Maybe they'll feel safer now that you're here.
Coriolanus noticed a boy of about 10 hovering in the crowd, holding a boiled potato. He gave him a wink and a wave of the hand. The boy looked up at his father, who nodded approval. He moved up behind Coriolanus, still keeping his distance. Did you bring that potato for Lucy Gray? Coriolanus asked.
Yes. I saved it from dinner. I wanted to eat it, but I wanted to feed her more, he said.
Go on, then, Coriolanus encouraged him. She doesn't bite. Mind you, use your manners. The boy took a shy step in her direction.
Well, hey there, said Lucy Gray. What's your name?
Horace, said the boy. I saved you my potato.
Aren't you sweet? Should I eat it now or save it? She asked.
Now.
The boy gingerly held it out to her. Lucy Gray took the potato as though it were a diamond.
My, that's about the nicest potato I've ever seen.
The boy blushed with pride.
Okay, here I go.
She took a bite, closed her eyes, and almost seemed to swoon.
Nicest tasting, too. Thank you, Horace.
The cameras closed in on them as Lucy Gray received a withered carrot from a little girl and a boiled soup bone from the girl's grandmother. Someone tapped on Coriolanus's shoulder, and he turned to see Pluribus Bell standing there with a small can of milk.
"For old time's sake,"
he said with a smile as he punched a couple of holes in the lid and passed it to Lucy Gray.
"I enjoyed your act at the reaping. Did you write that song yourself?"
Some of the more accommodating, or possibly the hungriest, tributes began to station themselves up by the bars. They sat on the ground, held out their hands, ducked their heads, and waited. Here and there, someone, usually a child, would run up and place something in their hands and then jump back. The tributes began to compete for attention, drawing the cameras to the center of the cage. A limber little girl from District 9 did a back handspring after she received a bread roll. The boy from District 7 made a good show of juggling three walnuts. The audience rewarded those who would perform with applause and more food. Lucy Gray and Coriolanus resumed their picnic seats and watched the show.
"We're a regular circus troupe, we are,"
she said, as she picked bits of meat off her bone.
"None of them can hold a candle to you," said Coriolanus.
Mentors who had been avoided before were now approached by their tributes if they offered food. When Sejanus arrived with bags of hard-boiled eggs and wedges of bread, all the tributes ran up to him except Marcus, who made a point of ignoring him entirely. Coriolanus nodded at them. "You were right about Sejanus and Marcus. They used to be classmates in District 2.
"Well, that's complicated.
At least we don't have to deal with that," she said.
"Yes, this is complicated enough." He meant it as a joke, but it fell flat. It was complicated enough, and it got more so by the minute.
She gave him a wistful smile.
"Sure would have been nice to meet you under different circumstances."
"Like how?" It was a dangerous line of questioning, but he couldn't help himself.
"Oh, like you came to one of my shows and heard me sing," she said. "And afterward you came up to chat, and maybe we had a drink and a dance or two."
He could imagine it. Her singing somewhere, like Pluribus's nightclub. Him catching her eye, connecting before they'd ever even met.
"And I'd come back the next night."
"Like we had all the time in the world," she said.
Their musing was interrupted by a loud, "Woo-hoo!" The tributes from District 6 began a funny dance, and the Ring Twins got some of the audience to clap along in rhythm. After that, things became almost festive. The crowd ventured closer, and a few people began to converse with the captives. On the whole, Coriolanus thought it a good development. It would take more than Lucy Gray to justify the primetime slot for the interviews. He decided to let the other tributes have their moment and to ask her to sing at closing time. In the meantime, he filled her in on the mentor's discussions that day and stressed what her popularity could mean in the arena, now that there was a possibility that people could send gifts. Secretly, he worried about his resources again. He'd need more affluent viewers who could afford to buy her things. It would look bad if a Snow's tribute received nothing in the arena. Maybe he should make it a provision of the proposal that you couldn't send your own tribute gifts. Otherwise, how could he compete? Certainly not with Sejanus. And there, by the bars, Arachne had laid out a little picnic for her tribute, a fresh loaf of bread, a block of cheese. And were those grapes? How could she afford those? Maybe the travel industry was picking up. He watched as Arachne sliced the cheese with a mother-of-pearl-handled knife. Her tribute, the talkative girl from District 10, squatted right in front of her, eagerly leaning into the bars. Arachne made a thick sandwich but didn't hand it right over. She seemed to be lecturing the girl about something. It was quite a speech. At one point, the girl reached through the bars, and Arachne withdrew the sandwich, drawing a laugh from the audience. She turned and flashed them a grin, shook her finger at her tribute, held out the sandwich again, and then pulled it away a second time, much to the crowd's amusement.
"She's playing with fire there,"
Lucy Gray observed. Arachne waved to the crowd and then took a bite of the sandwich herself. Coriolanus could see the tribute's face darkening, the muscles tightening in her neck. He could see something else, too. Her fingers sliding down the bar, darting out, circling the handle of the knife. He started to rise, opening his mouth to shout out a warning, but it was too late. In one movement, the tribute yanked Arachne forward and slit her throat.